Let's start with Strasser 5-Wien.
Yes.
Not very far outside of Vienna.
Vienna, 20, 30 kilometers outside of Vienna, northeast, I think.
Northeast. You mentioned the Kästner negotiations. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I did not know anything about it. And even when there was a Kästner trial in Israel, I was too young to be, it was in the 50s, I think. But my mother was very much aware and connected. I mean, we did not know what was going on when we were in the cattle cars. Anyway, I guess that's why we were not sent to Auschwitz straight. But we ended up in this place called Strassel bei Wien, which was a large gathering camp from which people, and I'm reading from my interview with my mother, people were sent to other smaller camps. For a while we were in this camp, but I don't know how long. I have no idea.
This was in June 1944.
It was about, yeah.
And probably as a result of negotiations between Kästner and Eichmann.
Yes.
It seemed Eichmann at one point said, put some Jews on ice to keep them at bargaining chips.
Uh-huh. I guess we were the one.
Was there another camp that you and or your mother went to? What was that?
The name of that camp was Moosbierbaum. And after the selection in Strasshof, which I don't know how long it took, we were sent to Moosbierbaum. And in Moosbierbaum, the camp, the labor camp, was next to a POW camp, which had, my mother said, 30,000 French POW. I don't know whether it's a realistic number. But these French POWs were helpful in a way to the Jewish prisoners because there was a trade of sex for food between the Jewish women of the camp. Now, I want to read to you this little segment about my mother. My mother traded her silk dress for a kilo sugar. Some women from the camp got together with the French POWs, sex for food. My mother was unwilling to do that, but she was willing to be the interpreter since she knew French. And she got a percentage of the deal. I used to have arguments with my mother about that, about her strict morality. The woman who traded the sugar for the dress was in the camp with her mother, father, mother-in-law, and son. Every night she would disappear and showed up in the morning with goodies. There was another woman, a woman whom my mother knew from Subotica, who said to my mother, you love yourself more than you love your children. Meaning, like, if you loved your children enough, you would do the same thing, let alone you speak French. But my mother had her own set of moral code. And I want to tell you another story that reflects that.
Let me ask you a question about this one.
Yes.
There's an idea that one author has about something he calls choiceless choices.
Yeah.
That the choices that were given to people at places like Auschwitz or in Moosbierbaum were essentially choiceless. There was no good choice to make.
Mm-hmm. But yet, I think this is a Viktor Frankl idea. Some choices, granted, we were not in a place like Auschwitz, but I guess there are still, people have a subjective view of what keeps them alive. And I guess for my mother, it was important to keep her own humanness in terms of her value system. That was very important to her. I guess for her, that these kinds of choices that were no choices were still making her the person that she was.
Do you think that what the woman said to her ever affected her?
She remembered it to tell me.
So she drained over it.
I think she thought about it, and maybe she needed to justify it to herself, because we would then argue about it later on when I was growing up. And
what did you argue?
I said to her, the woman was right. Leave it to cruelty of children. Said, of course she was right. Who cares? You know? But she stood her ground, even with the arguments with me. She said, you have to understand, we could not get down or stoop to their level. I couldn't. I had to maintain my own dignity. And she was a very dignified person. And she did. So I think that part of her determination to survive physically, she wanted to survive spiritually and mentally. And this was one way to survive. I am not going to be the animal you want to make me. I guess that's how I see it.
So you've changed your opinion.
I'm getting older too.
Let me just for a moment go back to something you said earlier. You mentioned that just the sight of trains has a very powerful
upsetting
effect.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And barbed wire.
Yes.
So you have a memory then?
I guess so.
Is there anything else that does it?
The barbed wire story is the strangest part of it all. I used to say, but we did not have barbed wire. I mean, we were not like in Auschwitz, and most of the films would show Auschwitz with a barbed wire. And so why am I reacting to this? And this, in 1984, when I interviewed my mother, she said to me there was a barbed wire around the camp. I had no recollection of it. All I knew was that I would have this argument with myself, like, why are you reacting? Saying to myself, why are you reacting to these pictures? After all, you were not in an extermination camp, and I knew from my mother's stories that the camp was fairly open. We would walk, or my mother would walk to her work. You know, 13 kilometers they walked to the place of work. So what's the big deal? But apparently there was a barbed wire. And even after I interviewed her, I forgot. I repressed it again. It's like the repression is incredible, how we just don't want to deal with some painful things, and we just kind of put it out of our minds. And the barbed wire apparently was one of them that I put out of my mind.
Are there other images that have you... Did you watch the Holocaust series in 1978?
Yes, I did. And I had a tremendous reaction to it. I said to my husband, my children were still young. My oldest at the time was 77?
78.
So my oldest was, Ruthie was 10. And I just had a baby, I think. or I was pregnant with my last child. And I looked through, I still remember the first segment of it with Kristallnacht. And I looked around and I said to my husband, well, it can happen here too. And I had such a strong feeling that it really indeed could happen in Southfield, Michigan. It's like nobody can change my mind. And you know what? I still believe it. I'm totally convinced that it can happen anyway.
What about Schindler's List, did you watch that? Did you see, you saw that film?
Yeah.
And your reaction to it?
My reaction to Schindler's List, this was already at the time when I said for a few years my husband put a ban on Holocaust movies. We have a very egalitarian relationship, and he does not allow me or not allow me to do certain things. That's not a concept that we use. But here he said, I'm not going to allow you to watch these movies. I wanted to see Schindler's List. And by then I went to see Europa, Europa, and The Last Metro, several movies that were upsetting. And I said to him, you know, so I'll cry. So what's the big deal? I'll cry. I'll get upset. I want to see it. Anyway, when we went to see Schindler's List, we went with, it was actually a benefit showing. And I think the whole audience was Jewish. It was for some charity. And we went with our Russian friends. And when they started showing the children the early on in the movie, I was very aware that I had to make a decision. I had to put a barrier between me and the movie. So I'm going to just kind of watch it and not immerse myself in it because I could not bear it. And actually when the movie ended and we left the theater, my husband and the friends were much more under the influence of the movie than I was, because I was so shielded. Like any trauma victim will tell you that they shield themselves from the trauma by numbing themselves, and I was numb. But if that's the price, then it's okay. I want to see these movies. And I always have reactions to visual effects. And I don't know whether the reaction to children is because I was a child just knowing that, or because I have some sort of a projection of myself. I cannot analyze that. But I really have a tremendous reaction. I become... I'm overcome with anxiety and upset.
It's in particular with children.
Yes, clearly. Yeah. And you know, emotionally, what overcomes me more than anything is fear. I'm just petrified. I have one memory from the camps. I don't know whether it was in Moos-Birbaum or in Strasshof, that I was in my underwear. See, I was left in the barrack all day long when my mother went to work, and my mother worked a shift and a half so she would get more food to give to my brother and I. And I asked her at the interview, where was I? What did you do with me? You know, I used to, when I raised four children, I would look at them at the age of three and think to myself, my God, how did I survive? And so she told me that there was an old lady and a grandmother who was there with her family, and she was in our barrack, and she would watch me. Anyway, one time, apparently, one of the guards came in And I know there was snow on the ground. And he kicked me out in the snow. I was in my underwear. And I remember that. When we went to Theresienstadt, in 1985, when that was my idea to take my whole family back to Europe, and we went to Hungary and Czechoslovakia. We couldn't get into Yugoslavia because of visa problems. And we went to Theresienstadt, and I saw the shelves. Again, I had that reaction. It was scary. I was very scared. So that is a screen memory of being thrown out in the snow.
Do you remember what happened after that?
No, not at all. I don't remember chronologically anything until liberation. From liberation on, I was almost 4 years old. I have clear memories. So before we go on, I would like to share with you this one story because I think it's a heartwarming story. I'm going to read this to you from what I wrote from the interview with my mother. During Christmas, my mother told my brother to go to the next town, which was Deutschwagram. I found it on the map. Of course, when we were in 85 in Europe, I did not look up Strasshof for Moosbierbaum or Deutschwagram. None of them had a reality. It did not even dawn on me to look up these places. But I looked at the map later on. I think, when I was transcribing the tapes for my daughter, that's when I looked up these places, and lo and behold, they exist in reality. That was a big shock. Anyway, so we were near Deutschwagram, which is a small town. And my mother told my brother to go and beg for food. She said, before Christmas, people get into themselves. This, she said it in Hungarian. And you should go and tell people that we are here, that your sister has outgrown her shoes and cannot get off the bed. And in general, beg. Yuri, my brother, said he did not want to go begging. He'd rather steal. Finally, my mother and Dr. Wilhelm, a family friend, convinced Yuri to go. He came back with a pair of shoes. And my shoes went to the youngest child of a woman who was in the lager with her 8 children. They all survived, but her husband never came back. Yuri told the story that he went to this farmhouse in the outskirts of Deutschwagram. There was a woman there with her children, and she asked him, who was there with you? And he told her, and she sent a pair of shoes for me, and she told him to come back a couple of days later and knitted some wool socks for me, and sent some other things, food, I think, and some other items of clothing. After liberation, I walked back in those shoes. This was an Austrian Gentile woman. There were people like that, too. Okay, what else? I need a little help now. Here I wrote much more about about the details about life in the camp and little different anecdotes. My mother told a story about that there was a Passover Seder in camp. How on earth? She said they even had parsley. Like, where did they get that? Or matzah, you know? Like, unbelievable. I asked her when I interviewed her, I said, where did they get these things? I'm looking for tissue. And she said, I have no idea. I never figured that out. But she said, I still remember she was telling me how we were lying on the shelves and there was one person conducting the Seder. Can you imagine? So there was one, I'm sorry.
You slept in the barracks with shelves, like in the parade and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I did not remember, but I remembered reacting in Theravian style. I was like, oh my God, you know. So I think that's what it was.
And had you heard anything about your father?
No. Until liberation. That came much later.
Yeah.
There was one other. I would like to share with you another incident that left a mark and even touched me deeply when I was interviewing my mother. The prisoners, the inmates, we organized different things in the camp. And one time, they were singing Zionist songs. There was a girl from Debrecen, my mother told me, of a city in Hungary, and my brother and my mother, and there were probably some others. And there was a Hungarian song which was in Hungarian, but the theme was about the land of Israel and the Maccabees who fought for freedom. And when she was talking about it in the interview, she and I started singing it. I remember the song. And the guard came and asked my mother, who spoke German, what are you singing? And she said, we are singing our national anthem. And she said even he was touched by the fervor and their what they put into singing that song. The reason I want to tell you this is because my parents were Zionists. And after the war, there was a decision to go to Israel. In fact, we tried to go to Palestine illegally and we were captured and my parents were in communist prison in Yugoslavia afterwards, but then they let us go, and in December 1948 we arrived in the shores of Haifa. But the Zionism was so important, it was like survival, like another one of the components of what kept my mother going, is that there was this homeland, there was this place where we would be free.
Do you remember the song?
Yeah, it would be too hard to sing.
Okay.
I would just cry. It's playing in my head.
You sang such songs with your mother in the camp, so.
Yes. We were a musical family. We sang then and afterwards, too. We were a singing family.
And did that keep you going? You keep your mother going?
I think so. And my brother. again, that spiritual survival was extremely important. And it affected us. It kept us going, I think.
You think that this was widespread in Strasser? Many shouldn't say.
I don't know. I really have no idea. But I know that it was so central to my family's survival, spiritual survival. Because when we were in Yugoslavia, as I said, you know, then it was prison. And then finally, when we got to Israel, we had nothing. We were extremely poor, just all other survivors. And there was something of spiritual, a faith, emunah in Hebrew, that kept us going and kept us eased the hardship, the struggle. My parents had to eke out a living in Israel. It was extremely difficult. We really had nothing, and they had no skills. And nobody had anything. So it was not like it stood out. The poverty did not stand out. But it was still never for a moment. There were people who left in the 50s. Left Israel, went to Canada, went to Australia, came to the U.S. It never entered my parents' mind. Actually, after the war, I had an aunt, a quite wealthy aunt, in Uruguay, South America. Through her, we had relatives in the United States. And we could have gone to either one of those places, but it was not even considered. I mean, it was considered not to go there, because never again are we going to go to a place which would be not our country now that we have our own. How I ended up here is another story.
When you were in Strasshof or in Mosbyland, do you recollect, does your mother tell you about any other time, your life as a child was in even more serious danger than it was as a rule, like the time of Guard 3 out in the cold?
She said many times when I was growing up, then when we came back from the camps, people would point at us, because my father came back as well. That's a whole different part of how he survived. But he came back the first night of Hanukkah in 1945. And then later on, we went back to Yugoslavia. And she said that people used to point at us in Europe. Here is a family that survived. Like we were unusual, because a mother and a father and children came back. So I was made to feel special in that way, a child survivor of my age was something unusual. And I was a very sickly child in Israel, and she used to constantly worry about me. When we got to Israel, I had rheumatic fever and all the childhood illnesses that you can think of. And she was always worried about me and my health. My brother later on went to Aliyat HaNoar. He came to Israel separately. And he being 9 years older later on, while we were in prison, that's a long story.
You were also in prison?
8 days. Both of us were just 8 days. Let me go, maybe, should we do a little chronological?
Yeah, let's tell me about The liberation, which you remember. You remember what you really told about the liberation. You were liberated by the Russians?
Yes, we were liberated by the Russians. One day there were no guards, and my mother, how on earth she had those two wheelbarrows, I don't know, but she had two wheelbarrows that I remember, and there was, prior to that, a German supply train was bombed. And it was had all kinds of food items, and apparently all the inmates of the lager went and gathered. You know, there was sugar there and oil and stuff like that. So whatever we got from there, we put in those wheelbarrows. And my mother said, "Let's go home." And we started walking. And the first recollection that I have from that time was, and this I can actually see, there was a gray picket fence around like a farm. And in the corner, there was like a gate to open for a carriage or for a tractor or something. In the corner, there were eggs, several broken and a few intact. There were 9 eggs. She told me they were 9, but I knew there was eggs. And my mother and my brother drank the broken ones. I mean, they just gathered and ate them. And I refused. I did not know what they were, and I didn't want to be bothered. But I still remember that gray fence and the eggs underneath. What is interesting is that my mother in the interview said that there was also a dead German soldier, which I blocked out of my mind. I don't remember that. But the eggs and the fence I remember. I also remember walking back. And I remember saying to my mother, I remember walking and walking and being tired. I was not 4 years old yet. And I said to her something like, "I am not tired yet, but when I will be tired, could we rest?" Something like that. And she kept on telling us that we had to get to the next town before dark. And meanwhile, there were bombings. The Allies were bombing. And every time there was like a bombs, we would go in a ditch. And she would put us under her, like my brother on one side and me on the other, and she would lie on us. And then we would say Shema Yisrael and pray. And when it cleared, we continued to walk. I think it took us 2 days or 3 days, I don't know how long, to get to Bratislava. And in Bratislava, by then they already had the Jewish agency, the joint, established these soup kitchens, and this distribution agency was giving out food to the survivors. And one day we stood in line for food, and they did not open yet. And there was a woman there saying, "I wish they opened already, because I have to get back to Stompa tonight." Stompa apparently was a suburb of Bratislava. So my mother said to her, "You are from Stompa, maybe you know the Stern family." And she says, "Yes, of course I know the Stern family. They just came back the other day from the bunker." shelter. They were hiding. So my mother asked her, would you be so kind to take a little note to them? So they took out a little newspaper and a pencil, and she wrote there, this is Lily Engel, that's Goldberger, May Goldberger. I'm here with my two children. I need nothing, only somebody who will recognize me, who knew me before. Anyway, the Stern family, when Czechoslovakia was taken over by the Germans, since Bratislava is so close, the Jewish family sent up their youngsters to Hungary, to Budapest. And the Jewish families of Budapest hired them so they will not be deported. So my mother hired a young girl from the Stern family, Ilonka was her name, to be a mother's helper.
Who were the Stern?
Just a Jewish family from Bratislava.
That your mother knew?
I don't know how she found this girl, but she was like an 18-year-old girl. And as long as we were in Budapest, she took care of me. The only condition was that she was not allowed to speak German to me, you know, because in Bratislava, all the Jews spoke German, Slovak, and Hungarian. Anyway, that was the connection. How much contact was... There was contact between the families, because what happened later shows that. Anyway, so my mother gave this note, and the next day, a Russian jeep stopped at the line. Again, they were standing in line for food. And a woman came and said, I'm looking for a Mrs. Engel. So my mother identified herself. And so she looked at my mother and she said, Rabbi Mishalala. She's like, oh my God. My mother was a very small woman, petite. But she was like all survivors. Anyway, it's a long story. She couldn't find my brother. She did not want to go that day. In fact, my mother said to her, Helga, this was Ilonka's sister. She says, Helga, you are so religious, it's Shabbos, it's the Sabbath. She said, we cannot worry now about the Sabbath, we have to save lives. They took us in, they fed us, they gave my mother medicine. By then, my mother was very, very ill with dysentery. And I don't think she would have survived at that point without this family. My mother said they gave her morphine. They did everything. They cleaned her, they washed her, they did everything. She traveled to Budapest and came back and told my mother that both her brothers were living. And after a while, we went back there. Now, this was in the summer of 1945. We did not know whether what was going on with my father. And we got word from the Red Cross. I have a piece of paper from the newspaper, how my father put an ad looking, and there were all these long ads, long lists of people, survivors looking for each other.
You have the ad?
Yeah. And so there was word from my father And then later on, somebody came back and brought a note from my father, and I have the note as well. And the first night of Hanukkah, this I remember. There was like a very wide street, like a boulevard, you know, in Budapest. Vilmos Császár út. I remember we were crossing it, and we ran into my mother's cousin, and he said to her, Lily, my mother's name, you at your brother's, there is a surprise for you. So she said, a surprise for me, maybe my brother bought Hanukkah presents for the kids. So he said, no, it's for you. And she said, did Geza come back, my father? And we went there, and I remember how we got up the stairs, and the door was open, and there was this tall Russian soldier. My father was in Russian uniform. He was a stranger. He was taken away when I was 11 months old, and I was 4.5 years old. I did not know him. And in fact, sometime a day or two later, or I don't know when, I said to him to go back to Russia because he took away my mother. I was extremely attached to my mother. I think that what remained with me, what I mentioned before, the fear, is an incredible abandonment anxiety that I worked on in my own psychotherapy. Being left in the barracks all day long, all the time. I don't know what it is. But then I see some of it in my daughter, Yael, and I used to say the concentration camp in Southfield, you know. But I was really extremely attached to my mother. There was a summer camp that we were sent to, all the surviving children, on the Dalmatian coast, and it was to put some life back into us, you know. That was in summer of 1946, and I missed my mother something terrible. That remained with me even when I was 12 years old in Israel. I went to a overnight camp for the first time, and I couldn't bear it. Physically, each time, these summer camps were very good for me in terms of the fresh air and the sun and the food. But emotionally, they were excruciatingly painful, being separated from my mother.
I think the roots are there in your Holocaust experience.
Definitely. Definitely. That's the fear, the abandonment anxiety, separation anxiety, that will be with me for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Not feeling safe. I remember when we went back into Yugoslavia in 46, the spring of 46, and then later on, we tried to cross the border back to Hungary to join the illegal immigration to Palestine. And we were caught, and we were in prison, and I was separated from my mother. And I was shuffled from relative to relative. And during that time, my brother left. He crossed the border himself, and he was not caught. And he went to his uncle's, and later on, he emigrated to Israel through the Aliyat HaNoar, the youth Aliyah. But I still remember, I have a vivid recollection when he came to say goodbye to me. Again, there was another separation from somebody who I was extremely attached to. So these multiple separations as a child were very traumatic. My daughter, my oldest, Ruti, says she looks at pictures of me following the war, and some of them, she says, I look traumatized. And they are actually the ones after this experience of going from relative to relative, and when my brother left, that's when I was like, and I look at the pictures, it's a sad-looking child, worse than right after the war. The picture that I have here with me from 1946, where we went to Cirkvenica, the same place where my father had the pension. We went back there as a family. And there, I look pretty happy. You know, I look pretty good. But I think that it was the frosting on the cake, if you will, in terms of the whole ordeal of being captured by the communists and being separated from my mother. My mother spending 5 minutes, I wish 5 minutes, 5 months in prison.
And you stayed with?
Different relatives. So I remember three different places where I was during that time.
And your father, was he also arrested?
Yes, my father was sentenced to 1.5 years hard labor.
For trying to immigrate to Palestine.
And actually it was the official, you know, when in the sentencing it said illegal emigration to Palestine. So they were not regular criminals or anything. In fact, when the Soviet bloc voted for the creation of the State of Israel in the United Nations, after that my mother was already released from prison. She started going from ministry to ministry to get the acquittal or the release, early release of my father, which was successful. He was released, and we left Yugoslavia on the second legal boat going to Israel. My mother told the story how she went to these different offices and talked to these officials and said, "You were fighting for your freedom as partisans in Yugoslavia. Now let me go, and I want to fight for my own country." So, she was an ardent Zionist. She had a lot of fire in her.
Do you remember the vote?
Yes. I don't know why I cry more when there were good things. But that's a psychologically, that's a known phenomenon. My father was, I think, in prison. Yes. And my mother was sitting in this room. We had an awful apartment post-war. We were sitting around this old Telefunken radio, you know, those old radios. I remember my mother being there, and I remember myself. I know there were other people, I don't know who. And we were counting as the vote was going on. And then it was unbelievable. Now that I think back of what we went through, and suddenly you hear the United Nations voting to have a country for Jews, I don't think that today we can really grasp the meaning of it. Was just something that people in their wildest dreams in the camps could not fathom or imagine. Today we take all these things for granted, but then something else.
Your parents were determined to go.
Yes, very much so. My mother more than my father, I think, but both of them were really determined to go to, first to Palestine and then to Israel.
And do you think the vote helped get your father out of prison?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Because basically the communist countries voted to get, along with the Soviet Union, for the establishment of the State of Israel, and they really were after people who were trying to smuggle money out and jewelry or whatever, but those who were caught were beaten to death. One relative of mine was in a communist prison, but the others by and large were let go, and my father was not an exception. There were quite a few who actually came from prison straight to the boat. My father did not come from the prison to the boat. There was a time that he stayed with us. I remember when he came back, they released him unexpectedly. We did not know, and it was a summer night, so this was like a maybe 5-6 months before we went. And the window was open to the street, the window of the bedroom. And he climbed in through the window. And my mother woke up startled, and she said, "Who is it?" And he said, "So who can it be?" So, and right then and there, we started preparing for departure. And in fact, we took our furniture, we took things with us.
While you were living in
Subotica?
Subotica. You went to school?
Yes. That's an interesting story. In the communist countries, they sent kids to school. First grade was at the age of 7 rather than the age of 6. My parents did not want me to go to a Hungarian school. See, in Subotica, I don't know what the percentage of Hungarians versus Serbians, what was the, you know, the ratio, but there were Hungarian schools and there were Serbian schools. Well, the Serbians were not known as anti-Semitic. The Hungarians were known as anti-Semitic. So I was sent to the Hungarian school, to the Serbian school, I'm sorry. They did not care about anything, whether I spoke Hungarian, that was my only language, but they did not want, and then they sent me to the Serbian school, like, who cares if you can understand the language or any of that. It was very important. The Serbians were not anti-Semitic, therefore you go to the Serbian school. Meanwhile, I was instructed in Hebrew. I had a private tutor. I think my cousin and I, Melamed, you know, and he taught us the alphabet and reading and writing. I don't remember. I remember reading lessons. So when we got to Israel, when we finally settled, it was April of 1949. And I was tested whether I could read and write in Hebrew, and I could. So they placed me in second grade, and I graduated. I finished second grade with my age group. And from then on, I went on regular education in Israel.
But were there any instances in Subotica of anti-Semitism when you were a child in school?
Yeah, when one Shabbat afternoon, one time I was going to a friend, and there were these kids who were harassing me, nothing different than any other place. And one kid was pointing at me to the older child, like, this is the girl that we see or whatever. And he looked at me, and in a loud voice, he said, "Oh, she is a stinky Jew." and he spat on the ground. So that stayed with me. There were some Hungarian peasants, actually, when we got to Subotica. The parents were Hungarian peasants. The younger people, they rented an apartment to my parents before the war, and they saved some of our things. They were very good to us, and they fed us. And the older, the Hegedűsnéni, the older peasant, Hungarian peasant lady, said to my mother once, Lilike, like a Lily, you are so nice as if you weren't Jewish. That was the big compliment, you know. And she meant it from the bottom of her heart. But that was ingrained. Anti-Semitism was ingrained. It was part of their thoughts and feelings.
Even in the Serbian school.
Yeah.
Can you stop here for me?
Thank you.